Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat. Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm Manoj Keval Ramani, and today I have with me Anupam Manur and Sarthak, and we're going to be talking about the impact of COVID on the Indian economy, but from a slightly different perspective. And we're going to be taking off from two news stories that developed over the last week or so. One was the People's Bank of China increasing its stake in India's HDFC Bank from 0.8% to 1.01%. And the other was this deal between Facebook and Reliance Jio, where Facebook essentially invested $5.7 billion in Jio, picking up just shy of 10% stake in the company. All of this is sort of coming in the backdrop of obviously an economic slowdown in India and also a debate over the need to protect strategic economic assets. So to unpack all of this, I've got Anupam and Sarthak with me. Guys, welcome to the show. Anupam, I want to begin with you. Firstly, just let's look at the FDI scenario in India. I mean, what's how much have we been attracting, and does the need sort of for greater investment grow given the economic slowdown that we're going to be seeing, already seeing, and we'll be seeing further down the road?
All right, I think I'm going to start with a very broad stroke here, saying that if you look at India's balance of payments, we are always in the kind of red territory when it comes to the current account, which is basically goods and services. We tend to import a lot more of goods and services than we export. But this has traditionally not been a problem because of the capital account, which is basically the financial flows into India, within which I think two or three kind of aspects stand out. One is NRI deposits, the least of probably the three. Remittances are a different deal. That's quite high, but that doesn't come here. The other two aspects are FII and FDI. And these two actually pretty much give us the comfort to import as much as we want. So we've always had a massive capital account surplus and a current account deficit. The difference between the two is goes into our foreign exchange reserves. And our reserves have been growing, which means that we're, you know, doing quite comfortably on that count. That's just the broad kind of backdrop as to how important FDI is to the Indian economy and to generally, you know, our entire balance of payments. Of course, things have changed since the beginning of this particular year. FDI has dropped, as pretty much everywhere around the world. No one at this time will go and invest in new factories in foreign lands or stock up on inventories in other lands, etc. So that FDI has fallen. FII has also obviously fallen since the beginning of this year, because actually FII has kind of fallen since quite some time, and that's largely because the US interest rates have been picking up, and because of that, you know, investors around the world have started going towards US markets. But since the beginning of COVID, there's increased kind of uncertainty in emerging markets, which means pretty much every other investors want to go to the safest possible asset, which is the US Treasury bond. So in that sense, we are losing out as well. This kind of brings increased focus and attention to how we're going to finance many of the, you know, economic projects that we plan to do once COVID kind of retreats. So once the pandemic retreats, we obviously have to indulge in extremely high kind of fiscal programs or expansive fiscal programs in order to help the economy rebound and reconstruct the economy. And therefore, we have to start looking at different kind of finances. Part of that, and I think what an important part of that would be foreign direct investments, because if you're looking at, for example, long-term infrastructure projects, we'll have to either borrow from abroad, we'll have to attract foreign capital into investing into some of this. That's just the broad context as to why FDI is important and why framing rules around FDI now becomes all the more important in the current scenario.
Okay, Sarthak, anything to add on the FDI front?
Yeah, no, I think I agree with Anupam in this. Especially when it comes to the post-recovery part after COVID, we will require finances, and FDI is going to be can be one of the vital way by which we can raise our finances. So I completely agree with Anupam on this.
Okay, so then I'm going to sort of pivot to what's happened in the last week or so, a little over a week, right? You had this deal, you had revelations from HDFC, which was routine, and they published their Patnaik, in which it basically said that, you know, the People's Bank of China, which had held previously a 0.8% stake in HDFC, had increased its stake to 1.01%. And that created this big furor. Now, part of it was because in the reporting norms, under 1%, if you're holding stake, it doesn't need to be reported. So now it got reported. But it created a massive furor in the media where there was lots of questions about, oh, look, the Chinese are coming to buy your strategic assets. I wanted to get your sense on that deal, Sarthak.
See, I don't think it should have created that big a furor. See, if you look at Chinese investments in India, they have increased drastically across sectors. If you look at the data of 2014, around $1.6 billion was invested in India. But in the next 3 years, between 2014 and 2017, it increased by around 5 times, $8 billion. And after that, also, there has been massive investments. And already some $26 billion of projects have been planned or announced across sectors. And whatever we are saying, these numbers that we say, they are all underestimates. It is said that, in fact, it might be even more, 25% more of these estimates. So already we are having massive Chinese investments, primarily driven by their private sector. And so this increase of 0.3% should not have created this kind of furor. And what we have observed now is, because there was a furor, now that there has been a government notification that countries which are neighboring India, if FDI is being directed from there to India, then there it has to pass through the government approval route. I think it is an exaggeration, or at least this kind of mechanism should not be there.
All right. Anupam, is that notification that Sarthak spoke about, which essentially talks about countries that share a land border with India will have, you know, any investment from those countries would have to be vetted by the government. Also, there's also something about the interpretation of that noting, right? Because it's unclear whether that will cover Hong Kong, the Hong Kong route. It's unclear whether that will also cover, say, a Chinese company which buys something in Singapore, and that Singaporean entity had stakes in an Indian company. Would then that investment be reviewed again because now a Chinese company has bought it and the PRC shares a land border with India? Some reports I was reading in the Economic Times say that yes, that will be the case. This would be utter madness in some ways, right?
Yeah, I think, I think they try to be a bit too clever in all of this. You could have just directly kind of said Chinese investment, or it would have probably been not very diplomatic, but or made a list of such things, or even better would have been to do it even more discreetly and just not mention anything, but kind of review, you know, Chinese investments. There's, I think, probably a better ways to have done it, but nonetheless, yeah, it was kind of a funny thing, because foreign capital at the moment is a very tricky thing. It's almost, you know, it's quite difficult to place exactly where it's coming from. As you said, I mean, if you look at some of the big Indian software and other companies, we clearly know that, you know, we think of them as Indian companies, but they, you know, necessarily not be so, because they're registered in Singapore. They probably have entirely funded by SoftBank or some other company and so on. So these things kind of get trickier in this globalized world, and therefore pinning your entire rules on physical kind of land borders doesn't seem to be the smartest way to go about it. And I think I read that, you know, again, Hong Kong, as you said, Hong Kong is, I mean, investment from Hong Kong will be included in all of this. So will, you know, many other, even if it's in the indirect ways, I think they're saying that it will be included. But there's, again, this leads to uncertainty in the entire process.
Okay, and so then let's look at a deal which did eventually go through, which is after this notification was issued, although it wasn't notified. It got notified yesterday in the Gazette. So the Reliance, Jio and Facebook deal probably does not fall into that, but I'm uncertain about that. But it was, the news came out yesterday that, you know, that Facebook is spending $5.7 billion for a stake in Jio. Sarthak, I wanted to first get your take on this particular deal. And I mean, it's fun, strange contrast to happen within a week, right? And it tells us a little bit also about the geopolitics of all of this.
Yeah, so basically, it seems that we do not have a coherent strategy when it comes to trade and investments. On one side, you are putting caps, putting restrictions. On the other side, you are letting this. But one thing has to be pointed out here, that this deal right now has happened, but yeah, it is still to go to the Competition Commission. So again, we will see how it pans out. But yeah, if you look at the impact of the deal on Reliance, if the impact of the deal on Jio, the impact on overall consumer base in India, it will vary. For Reliance, Again, they are having a huge debt of 1.53 lakh crores. They have been trying to reduce their debt. This is one way by which they can reduce their debt. When it comes to Facebook, they are getting access to a huge geographical reach. They're also getting access to huge data. They had been trying to penetrate for some time now into the Indian markets, but they had found it difficult. Now, this is one way by which they can do it. When we look at consumers, because now you are having more number of players, there will be more competition. It is definitely going to benefit the consumers. So when it comes to e-commerce, already Amazon and Flipkart are there. You have one more competitor. When it comes to different digital payment platforms, again, you have Google Pay and all these things. You are now going to have a few more competitors. Also, the way they have mentioned all these things in the media statements that they are going to co-opt different Kirana stores. So it also shows that it is going to include this segment of this segment, which is generally up and arm against this. So, and also there might be competition between these Kirana stores, which again might lead to greater efficiency, might benefit consumers in the long run. It might create greater business opportunities.
So interestingly, see, there's, as I think Sarthak was saying, we do not have a very coherent kind of strategy on some of these things. So for instance, e-commerce tends to be, you know, I mean, currently the rules on e-commerce is made by, you know, made through, you know, rules about FDI rather than through competition rules. And you have DIPP suddenly coming into this picture and making rules about certain things, whereas, you know, some other platforms are governed by an entirely different set of rules, etc. So I think you need a slightly more coherent strategy saying if it is mergers and acquisitions, then it will be dealt with, you know, Competition Commission to do with competition aspects, and then of course some kind of Ministry of Finance or SEBI to do with, you know, FDI rules. But who has the authority on some of these things, and what exactly are the criteria for allowing/disallowing should, I think, be a lot more clearer, because if not, again, you've essentially not allowed Amazon to do a bunch of things, but you're now allowing Reliance to do it because it was thought of as a purely, you know, domestic company, but now Facebook has gotten into the mix. So, you know, it's a massive, I think, confused kind of state of affairs that we are in. And that should be clarified. But I think I want to take it to the next thing and kind of bring Manoj's perspective into all of this. Manoj, this is not the only place where, you know, special kind of rules have been made for Chinese investments, right? I mean, we've kind of spoken about this earlier, where US, for example, has an entirely special kind of rules on Chinese acquisitions and for every other country, right? I mean, they might do it more discreetly. They might do it a bit more in sophisticated terms, but essentially that's what it is. Chinese acquisition of, let's say, startups and other kind of, you know, tech companies in the US must go through an entirely different set of procedures than other kind of acquisition, right? I think right now, even Europe is trying to wake up to this and creating special rules for Chinese investments in their country. So this kind of special focus and special set of rules for China is not new. Is that kind of justified? Should we be doing that? Would you prefer kind of blanket rules? Because China obviously gives this, you know, I think opportunity for countries to do this, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the sort of trend. So in the US, in the last couple of years, you've seen much more of this. And it's done under the Committee on Foreign Investment in the US, CFIUS. And the idea there is that this is an interagency committee with the Treasury essentially taking charge of things. But the mandate is quite limited. It comes to the point where it's expanded. So the definitions of these things can be fairly vague. So you started to expand the jurisdiction of CFIUS in the US. And it's, for the last couple of years, Chinese acquisitions have been in question. The idea is that CFIUS is going to be looking at mergers, acquisitions, takeovers, essentially where the investor can get a hold of some degree of voting interest or through a proxy or directly. And that's where, you know, where you can take decisions into governance of the company and things like that. That's when CFIUS essentially takes the note of things. But it doesn't necessarily vet every investment before it comes through. That's not how it was functioning. But that's changing. And in the case of, say, Grindr, which was the case which became very, very famous last year, it was, you know, a gay dating app had Chinese investment in it, and they were essentially asked to, they were opposed the transaction, they were put in for a review, and just the nature of how things have changed because of data security issues, that investment was, they were asked to wind down that investment. So that's the nature of how things have toughened in the US. In Europe, this is happening more so right now. So in the last couple of years, there's been an issue over certain technology companies and sort of what was seen as Chinese acquisition of high-tech companies where, say, robotics or things like that. That's now expanding to a wider set of things, because right now the Europeans are essentially saying that, look, we're in deep distress and we need to be wary about any sorts of strategic purchases that happen. But at the same time, we need to sort of keep in mind that going down the road, we'll need money. So money is fine till sort of things change in terms of ownership, or effective governance can be changed within an organization. And I think that's where the challenge lies. And to me, that's a good model, even from an Indian point of view. I mean, I don't think we should be having a blanket ban on anything, but we should be looking at whether there is a governance shift that can potentially happen, and also the nature of the industry in which this is happening, and accordingly. So there has to be far more nimble rulemaking than, you know, using a cannon to hammer in a nail. We need to do much more nuanced stuff. I mean, that's my sort of sense on this. I don't think, because we will need, I mean, over the last few years, if you see the biggest investors in India's sort of tech and startup ecosystem have been the Chinese and American investors, with the Chinese investing a significant amount. So we'll need that money. That money needs to go somewhere where it's productive. And I think it's not a bad idea to do that. So, but we need to create rules where at least you don't sort of give away governance rights. At the same time, I think we need to do some of the things that this Facebook and Jio deal sort of tells us, is that, like Sarthak mentioned, right, they'll get access to massive amounts of data, yet our data governance rules have still not been framed. While we are saying things like, you know, India believes in data sovereignty and all of that stuff, we don't have the rules framed, and these deals are happening. So it's not just that we need to look at the Chinese. I think we need to look at the whole ecosystem. That's sort of my take on all of this.
I also agree with you on this, Manoj. So rather than saying that investments from this particular country should be scrutinized more, rather than that, what you can do is you can look at certain sectors or certain issues that are prominent. Maybe data security is something, or if there is a chance of digital authoritarianism or surveillance, censorship. So these are the things that we need to consider, and it can be investment from any countries. You have to ensure that this thing should not happen. Or if this is happening, then you can restrict the investments. So blanket bans from countries, or country-specific blanket bans, should not be there.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, right? I mean, for right now, there's much more intelligent ways to do this. So look at specific sectors which are probably more, you know, again, of strategic nature, which requires this kind of scrutiny. Maybe put a cap on it. I mean, as in anything below, I mean, I'm just throwing numbers out of my hat. I let the, you know, people in the know kind of get the nuance right. But, you know, anything below 10% stake, for example, can go through. But anything above that would require kind of approval. I mean, you can choose what that number is. It could be 10, it could be 5, it could be 20. But put a number like that. And I think the other kind of intelligent thing to do was also probably put a sunset clause on this. Yes, right now you are having distressed companies which can be easily bought, but that's not going to be forever. Once the kind of pandemic retreats, you're going to see economic kind of rebound, etc. And at that point of time, you probably will not have Indian companies which can be bought quite so easily. And then, therefore, you know, you probably do not require this level of scrutiny at all. And that kind of, you know, changes the entire landscape. So these are ways in which you can bring about nuance such that you can kind of maintain your interests, strategic interests, but also address the issue of liquidity and this kind of, you know, starvation of capital. I mean, let's admit that India is a country which is starved of capital, and we're going to need a lot of it as we go ahead, especially in order to, you know, kind of rebound from what we are now. And so, you know, doing anything that can harm that interest would also be kind of, you know, counterintuitive. So you need to balance the two, as I think Manoj has been kind of constantly saying throughout. You need to balance the two, and that would definitely be, you know, the way to do it. And but I still kind of, you know, hop back to one kind of interesting thing, Manoj, is what makes, you know, back to your own original question, but I'm throwing back to you, what makes Chinese investment different from US investment? I would, you know, think of two or three things. One, of course, we, you know, share a land border. Two, you have, you know, of course, skirmishes now every now and then with China, but not with the US. And probably three is that you can probably hold some of the US companies to greater accountability and scrutiny rather than Chinese companies, because you know where how and where US companies are funded, who do they report to, etc. I mean, Facebook is not a tool of the Congress, US Congress that is, but not Indian Congress, US Congress and US government. But you can kind of say that Alibaba will bend over for the Chinese interest, right? So how big a difference does that make in, you know, singling out China? And is that the reason why everyone is kind of making special rules for China as against even rules for, let's say, India or any other country which is investing?
Yeah, I think there is a couple of things there. I mean, everything that you said, yes, that's absolutely the case. And as all of that sort of ties into this fundamental notion of a lack of trust of the Chinese system. And that has a lot to do with the opacity of the system and the party states, the connections with the private sector. The other thing is that, there's been a greater concern about Chinese using, and it's not them, they who do it alone, everybody does it, but they've done it at a sort of accelerated level. You know, they dialed up the notch sort of very, very high. So just using economic coercion because you create dependencies. And they've shown that they will do that, right? They'll use that coercion for political ends. Other countries will do it, but the threshold at which they will do it probably will be far higher. And the Chinese have done this far more. So that's created far greater anxiety. The third thing is, again, this case of, you know, how, because of the opacity, you don't sort of trust how your data will be secured, how, what sort of, you know, protections you get, how, where the money eventually goes. And so there's a little bit of lack of clarity in all of that. And over a period of years, this sense that, you know, China has risen, and that's created anxieties. And I think that's just the anxieties of states, developed countries, facing the anxiety of developed states is essentially that you've got a new big competitor, and the anxiety of in India is that you've got a massive competitor on your border with whom you share a disputed border and with whom you've had a history of mistrust and even conflict, and this sort of the border incidents continue. At the same time, the Chinese have this relationship with Pakistan where you constantly have the sense that they have nurtured somebody next door to you to ensure that you don't rise. So that entire context frames in Indian view. But from a developed world's perspective, I think it's more to Europe and the US, it's more to do with there is a new competitor and we need to compete with that competitor as opposed to aid its development. And this sense that our openness has aided China's rise and today it's competing with us and coercing us, that sense, I think, has created much more of this, that, you know, we don't want to facilitate it much more. And there is a grain of truth in all of that. There is a grain of truth in all of that, as much as there is a grain of truth in the fact that this is geopolitics. You know, both sides are competing and you're trying to preserve your superiority over the other. And there's no morality in that. It's just power as it is. It's realism. So I think that's where the Chinese essentially get targeted.
Yeah, but I'll probably this is the time to end things, but I want to end it on a strange note where I sort of admire the Chinese in a particular way, and kind of wish that we had the same sense, and that is in terms of, you know, being opportunistic. This is a country which is completely devastated, which was completely kind of devastated by the pandemic, and you're already looking at you're seeing them look out for opportunities, saying how can we make use of this crisis in order to increase our stake in other countries, etc. Right? That is kind of, in a strange way, it is admirable that they're opportunistic in that sense and looking out for opportunities for where they can gain. And I rue the fact that India is not like that. Look at this oil crash, for example. We've been looking at filling up our strategic petroleum reserves or building capacity to fill it up for the last, 10 odd years. And we, right now, when the oil has crashed, we just don't have that capacity. We've not built those underground, whatever, caverns, etc. Look at, for example, the trade war. We lost out that opportunity of attracting, manufacturers into India. Right now, for example, there are probably manufacturers who want to move out of China just so as to diversify. And again, we're not in a position to take advantage of that. So, we're always caught a step short in any of these circumstances. And that kind of is rueful, that kind of is, and we're just not there. We're not opportunistic enough. We're not looking out as to how can we take advantage of situations, but we're always caught, a step back.
I can add to your consternation about the fact that we are not in a position to attract supply chains. I can add to that with something that I read last week. There is a committee that's been set up.
Of course. The committee.
Which committee?
Sarthak, any last thoughts before we wrap up?
No, just the same thing that Anupam was saying. So I was also reading one thing that we could have possibly leveraged our expertise in IT sector. But I found out that one of the companies which has a major investment, Indian company which has a major investment in China when it comes to IT is NIIT. And what they are doing, they are basically training their future IT force. So who are going to compete with us? So again, so that is the case. We have not used the opportunity maybe, and we are losing out.
All right. So on that somber note, just a couple of points to recap. We need FDI. That's going to be important to us. But we need sensible rules and no blanket bans. And we need to also protect our strategic assets. But for that, we need sensible rules. At the same time, we also need to have our domestic sort of systems in place, whether it's with regard to data regulation or other things. And those are the kinds of things that will help you compete better and maintain your sort of strategic autonomy also. Thank you, Anupam. Thank you, Sarthak.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is at IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at Takshashila INST or our website takshashila.org.in.